The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
Thank you for being here. My name is Brad Hambrick. I am the pastor of counseling at the Summit Church. It is a joy to get to be here. I'm encouraged that the subject of depression and anxiety will get a turnout like this where I guess we're officially standing room only. We're slightly sitting on the tables room only. But this is a subject that I think warrants more attention. We're going to talk about this from a ministry setting. I am a pastor of counseling. I don't hold a clinical background. My counseling training is seminary-based training. I have ministered in the parachurch setting, which is kind of paraprofessional, parachurch at times, and how it's set up, meeting with people by appointment. But in terms of using the DSM and prescribing medication or making formal diagnosis, my background, even when it has been very formal counseling, has been ministry-based counseling. I don't see that there has to be a lot of odds between those two, so I'm not advocating for one being superior to the other. I'm just doing what's called informed consent and full disclosure. I'm letting you know what my training and background is and is not. As a pastor, I don't think people get nearly as confused when it is just pastor in your title. When you have pastor of counseling in your title, then people want to know what exactly do you mean by counselor. The counseling that I would do would be ministry-based, not clinically based. Looking at it there, description, basically we're going to say depression and anxiety are the common cold of human experience. And those words, if you will, the word depression and the word anxiety, they are about as broad as the word dog. If I tell you I have a dog, you have no idea what I mean. You know it's got four legs, it barks, and a wet nose. But it could be as small as a poodle, which is a cat that barks. It could be as big as a Great Dane, which is a horse that people let live in their house. The word dog only tells us so much. And the word depression and anxiety, it only tells us so much. And so just because somebody says, I'm depressed, we should assume we know as much about that person as somebody who says, I have a dog. And it doesn't do us any good to project our experience of having had a dog on their statement that they have a dog. The most important thing that we would want to do next is ask some questions. Now, in the early part here, I'm going to hit a few things that are a bit more kind of philosophical and theological foundations. Then towards the end, we'll hit the practical stuff. Some of the early part here is hopefully trying to debunk some of the debates. And the best answer to most of the debates, in my opinion, is I don't know. Is a particular instance of depression or anxiety caused by a chemical imbalance? I don't know. The body fluid sample test that we would need for that, we don't have. And so it is oftentimes a diagnosis by elimination, and sometimes it is as much an attempt to provide relief to somebody who is hurting as it is to cure a disease, even when you're talking to the physician or psychiatrist. And so in that sense, I don't think we have to be ministerially territorial. You don't have to agree with me, but these are the kinds of questions that people want to know before they hear a guy talk in front of the room. It's like, what position are you going to take on these kinds of things? I don't think our faith is any stronger because we face depression and anxiety without medication. I don't think our faith is any weaker if we face it with medication. because I place medication in the wisdom category, not the moral category. Is it a good fit for me and my struggle, not is it right or wrong? Now, I say that as a fully ornery person at the first person level. When I played sports, I did not want to take anything for pain because I wanted to know how bad I was hurting. I'll resist taking cold medicine. My wife will tell you I'll bellyache for hours and days before. But that's just because I'm ornery. There is no redemptive merit to it. So those are some of the kinds of things that I think we're asking. So we get to a very foundational level question. Why is it that people experience depression and anxiety? Because there's this odd phenomena that, as best we can tell, people get ulcers and zebras don't. The zebras are out there, they're in a pack, and the lion comes up, and he's looking, and they all kind of know, and the spook reflex hits, and they all take off, and as soon as they settle back down, they go right back to grazing on the prairie. We are under much less existential threat, but we get ulcers. Why? We live in houses. We have alarm systems. Why is it that that part of creation, which is most safe and developed, gets ulcers when that part of creation that is perpetually living out in the open with predators all around doesn't? Well, I think there are a couple of aspects of humanity that account for that. Our ability to anticipate and reflect. So if we think for just a moment, what was it, kind of early Genesis 1, 2, and 3, kind of Genesis 1 and 2, life is good. Adam and Eve were fully content to let God be God and for them to live in the moment. And then Satan comes up and he says, hey, you eat this fruit, and you're going to get to be like God. Now, I think one of those qualities that's embedded within that is something we know about God is He exists outside of time. He is as fully present in the future, in the present, and in the past. He lives on the outside of that. Okay? Got a little jealous on that one. I want to prepare for the future. And so this ability to live in all three time zones, if you will, is a very significant factor in why we have made some of the astounding advancements that we have. I mean, if you think about the ability to reflect on the past and learn from our mistakes, the ability to anticipate the future and see what might happen, those are profoundly beneficial skills that we have. But they can also be emotionally debilitating. So just because we're rooting our understanding of depression and anxiety in the fall does not mean that we are saying that all depression and anxiety is sinful. Because part of the product of the fall is suffering as well. We got cancer from the fall just as much as we got adultery. And so it just says part of it is that living in three different time zones all at once, so that the basic advice, I'm losing the person who said it, wherever you're at, be all there. We fail miserably at that on a regular basis. And so I'm getting out of order on my notes here, but I tend to do that. One of the premises that I have is that there are, how do I say that? There are just as many people who avoid getting help because of the stigma of mental illness, anxiety, and depression. And so they just resist it, as there are people who use those labels as a crutch and don't do what they should do. And so whether it's 50-50 or 60-40, I don't know. But I think those are comparably large groups. And what I think many, I don't know, maybe most people in my position tend to do, they see the weakness on one side of the issue and they kind of harp on that side of it. I don't think that does us much good, because we are shepherding as pastors a congregation. Counseling is very individual. And so when I'm talking with an individual, if somebody is avoiding something because of stigma, I can be a bit more direct on that because I'm talking to that individual who has a particular disposition or bent. If somebody's using this as a crutch to say, I can't do basic life functions that I really need to do and it's going to impair other people if I don't, I can emphasize that to that person. When we're talking about these matters, when we're talking to a room full of people, some of us which lean one way on this issue, some of which, then we need to be able to speak to both sides of it. So, another way of framing the question. When is depression and anxiety sinful? Okay, we're pastors. Big conviction of mine. We need to be just as skilled at pointing people to Christ for comfort in their suffering as we are at pointing people to Christ for forgiveness of their sin. The gospel speaks to both sin and suffering. It speaks to them differently. We want to be skilled shepherds of ministering and being the ambassador of Christ for both. But it does mean we got to sort our emotional laundry a little bit. How do I know, okay, Jesus, you're good for both? If this is rooted in my beliefs and my values and behaviors, and I am just wrenching myself emotionally because of what I'm doing, praise God, there is forgiveness and redemption for that. Okay, if this is something that's not rooted in those things, but is more in my surroundings or in my physiology, and that's leading me to be stressed, I can lean into you for comfort in the midst of my suffering and encouragement and perseverance. You are faithful for to forgive. You are faithful to comfort. Okay, which way am I leaning into you? Does that question make sense? So, we look here. And we would say, we know not all depression and anxiety is wrong. Because there's the suspense of a good book or movie or ball game. I mean, we get all wound up in that. And that's entertainment. There's crying with a friend at the loss of a loved one. Somehow weeping with those who weep is not a violation of rejoicing in the Lord always. There is something good and Christ-like in that unpleasant emotion. And too often, we have taken the emotional spectrum and we've said the pleasant end of the emotional spectrum is good and the unpleasant end of the emotional spectrum is bad. Well, intuitively, that makes sense because kids come to us when they're sad and they say, I feel bad. Okay, and we got to know, does your tummy hurt? Did somebody hurt your feelings? What does that mean? But at this stage in our life, we need a better conceptualization than to say, unpleasant was over here. Unpleasant, bad, pleasant, good. You can look at the other examples there. So we said, how do we take passages like Philippians 4, rejoice in the Lord always, and Matthew 5, blessed are those who mourn, and help them reconcile? Because both theologically and personally, I think we would say we agree with both of those. Yes, God has done amazing things in that we should be able to rejoice in that irregardless of circumstance. There are circumstances that are hard where the most godly thing we can do is cry. Even when you think about Jesus, when he is there, and we've got the verse that we all love to memorize in Bible school, Jesus wept because it was short and easy. In that moment, Jesus knew within 10 minutes he was about to make all the sad things untrue, J.R.R. Tolkien style. But he would not withhold himself from being fully present with the grief of those that he was around, even when he knew what he was about to do. And so, I think they're in this, if we take those kind of commands, I think taking it as a warning, that if our immediate circumstances completely removes any capacity we have for joy and peace. Okay, something's wrong. Something's off. Because we've just moved from grief to despair. And that becomes dangerous. When we don't think, it's not just that things are bad, it's that they're never getting better. That's when we're a threat to harm ourselves and others. And we would expect a flag to get waved of warning, kind of look out on that. And then there, my oldest son is 13. This illustration was a lot happier for me when they were little and it was further away. But you think about when your kids get ready to get in the car for the first time. Talk about anxiety. I still remember this. It's just a throwaway anecdote. The first time I had my driver's license, like full-on driver's license, I'm from Kentucky. We grew up 30 minutes from the nearest McDonald's. When they paved the road in front of our house, my brother was not happy because it meant we didn't live in the country anymore. But we were on this hill, and there's a great big blind curve right there, and just, I don't know if God wanted to torture my mother or what, but I was over at a friend's house. My mother comes home, and there is a vehicle flipped upside down in our front yard as she is driving home on the first day that I was out in my driver's license without a permit. And I'm just thinking, please don't do that to me. It wasn't me. I was safe, but she was freaking out, and that was before cell phones. But as parents, When we say to our kids, drive safe, is that a command? Is that a keep your hands at 3 and 9? Do not play with the radio. Do not get on the... Are we giving a law there? It is an imperative, but it's a certain kind of imperative. It's a, I love you. You are precious cargo. Don't let something trivial get in the way of something that would grieve me deeply. There's a certain kind of command that's being given there that doesn't... I expect it to be followed, but I'm also not trying to be a police officer when I do it. It is a fatherly kind of command. It's kind of like when I send my boy somewhere, and this is just how we talk again. I'm from Kentucky, and I'm like, dude, don't be a knucklehead, okay? And they kind of know that just means don't get in mischief. And at that moment, they're not going, oh, my daddy insulted me. He called me a knucklehead. It's just like, okay, that kind of goofy stuff that I do, this is not one of those times to do that. I think that is a way to look at it here. Because beyond saying that these unpleasant emotions can be just not bad, they can also be good. Yet, so this is where I go kind of counseling nerd on you. I am not a clinician, but I try to be clinically informed in the counseling that I offer. The neurological cocktail, whatever it is that's going on in here between the synapses, between panic and euphoria, between compassion and depression. The difference is not in the biology. It's in the interpretation we place on the experience. And so when you're at your favorite sporting event and you're screaming your head off because your team is down by one with 3 seconds to go and they've got a shot to win the game, and all of that pupil dilated anxiety reflex that you've got going on, we don't call that anxiety. We call that excitement. We call that suspense. It neurologically, it's no different. Narratively, it's different. Interpretively, it's different. My experience of that biological state is interpreted differently. So here is where, if you'll let me say it this way, by and large, most every highly anxious person I've ever met is really sweet. I mean, there are very few jerks who are highly anxious. You can probably prove me wrong. I would trust you on that. But think about it with me. You're at a restaurant with a friend. You're sitting there. They excuse themselves from the table for a moment. They're gone for a little too long, a little bit longer than a little too long. And you're trying to think, are they sick? Was it something they ate? Was it something I said? Did they get a phone call and there's an emergency going on? Is that compassion or anxiety? I don't know. Again, sometimes the best answer we can give is I don't know. And I think that's the answer oftentimes as Christians. We're just not comfortable giving. But in that moment, it really could be either. It could be a mix of both. I like to quote Russian novelists because it makes me sound smart. But Fyodor Dostoevsky, he said, the line between good and evil goes straight down the middle of the human heart. So do I even have to parse that moment out to such a degree that I know whether it was fully Christ-like in compassion or whether how much of it was anxiety? If it's causing life interference, I want to understand that the best I can. And that's where we kind of go on the top of the next page here. This is at the functional level of how do we understand when an emotion is becoming counterproductive. And even counterproductive is not the same thing as saying immoral. Because I'm enough of an athlete, I have used anger and bitterness and revenge against our rival that I'm pretty sure that wasn't Christ-like. But it worked.
And it was fun at the moment.
It was productive. And so here we're not necessarily saying productivity equals moral and lack of kind of counterproductive means immoral, but it's one of those gauges. And this is where in my approach to sitting down and having a conversation with someone, if we're uni-gauged, I made that word up, my high school English teacher, who was also my aunt, like 75% of the other teachers in my school, because I went to a very small Kentucky school, she would tell me I'm not supposed to make up words, but I'm like, if you know what I mean and it communicates well, then it's okay. She was my aunt, so it wasn't talking back in the classroom. It's just kind of what you did over fried chicken. If we are uni-gauged in ministry, meaning we got one gauge for kind of how we determine the weight of everything, chances are we're going to miss some important stuff. And so here we're just taking kind of one gauge. How does anxiety and depression impact our function? Well, what this kind of chart means is if we're not experiencing any distress, we're a couch potato and a bum. There's just no oofta. Got that from somebody from Wisconsin. There's just no oofta to kind of get us doing whatever it is that life would want of us. And then you kind of hit this level where stress and, okay, things are going well. And there's that optimal range. And if you're type A, you want to know where's the peak on the mountain. I'm not going to tell you that. We just want to be kind of in the general vicinity up near the top 10, 15% going either way. But then you hit that spot where the level of stress that you're under, you've experienced this when you took a test and you studied so much and cared so much about the test that it actually hurt your performance. And now you're not doing as well. This happens to the athlete on the field of play when they get the moment means so much to them that they can no longer perform optimally. That's why sports psychologists will tell athletes you have to be NATO, not attached to the outcome. That you, when you get to thinking about the result more than the moment, again, those time zone kind of deal, then your performance tanks. And so I just give you some questions here. The more the answers to these questions tend to be yes, the more there's a moral component in the anxiety and depression. There's going to be plenty of times when the answer is no. Does your depression and anxiety come from doubting God's goodness, from trying to control things that are only God's to determine? If every person that you talk to, you perceive their struggle with anxiety and depression as yes answers to all of these, you're probably not listening to them. You're reading your interpretation on them. In the same way, okay, in ministry circles, this one to get our toes. If when we pray, all we hear God say is do, 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 and we never hear Him say rest, we're practicing selective listening in our prayer life. We're imposing our own drive onto what God would could rest made the top 10. He says, come to me when you're weary and heavy laden. I want to give you a break. If we come and every person that we talk to, we just see in what's going on, yes, answers to these questions, that's probably our filter more than their life. On the same hand, if we see all no answers to this, that's probably our filter more than their life. Yet, as believers, we are simultaneously sinner, sufferer, and saint. All three of those are going on with us at all times. We still have that corrupt part of our nature that wants things that it ought not want and does things it ought not do. We have that side of us that is just facing the hardships of living in a broken world with broken people. We have that aspect of us that finds our identity in different things. And all three of those are going to be active in probably any given emotional experience. So, basic pastoral care. Some of this I hit on earlier just because in my mind when I wrote the notes, it made sense to do it one way. And when I was talking here, it made sense to do it a different way. So, basic pastoral care. Pastoral or one another care. So, give you an idea for my categories here. When people say, what is counseling? I don't know. I am one and I don't have a clue. Because you can define counseling on a spectrum. Counseling can be every helpful conversation. If you want to make me hyperventilate, at Summit Church, where we're 9 campuses, however many people there on the weekend, if you try to make me the pastor of every helpful conversation, I will straight up get in the fetal position with you. How do you do that? And then counseling can go to levels of formality. That it is somebody who's in the midst of a major life struggle or transition talking to somebody that they perceive to be an expert, and it's this one-way formalized relationship by appointment. And there's all different degrees of formality across that spectrum. Church life care tends to be much more at this end of the spectrum. It's doing life together. It's we're part of the same small group, same Sunday school class. We serve on the same ministry team. Our kids are the same age. I think your kids behave better than mine, so I want to be friends with you, so they'll rub off on them. It's that kind of life. It's matters get disclosed because of the quality of our relationship. This part's free. When people ask me, like, Brad, when are you a counselor? Like, is there a hat that you change? Is it a cape that you put on? When is it that you're a counselor? And in some ways, this parallels to when are you a pastor? There are two tests that I run that in my mind tell me whether somebody's talking to Brad or whether they're talking to the pastor of counseling. And those are two totally different conversations. Yet I coach Little League sports because I want a place where I get to be Brad. And I need Brad settings. Again, that's free. But how is it that I know if people are talking to Brad or pastor of counseling? What is the rate of their disclosure? Are they disclosing at a rate that is greater than the quality of our relationship? Yeah, I've been wanting to ask you this question, not because I know you, but because, hey, your picture's on the website and you're the guy who knows these things. Okay, at that point, they're not talking to Brad. They may like me. They may have watched some videos. They may have read something I've written. They may see Facebook posts of my kids doing stuff. But we're not friends. They're talking to pastor of counseling. So the rate of disclosure and the weight of my words. I was walking with one of the guys on our staff, and we were just bantering. It was getting cold and dark, and I made some quip about emotions. I don't even remember what it was. I was being snarky, kind of like you can imagine me being from this presentation. And he says, oh, well, you're a counselor. I guess you know those things. Again, we talked this way. I was like, shut up, man. I was just being goofy. Oh, okay. Well, at that moment, he put an artificial weight on my words. When we talk about pastoral care, there's some sense by virtue of the office that we hold that begins to happen, that your words are God's words, unless I don't like them. And then there's the devil's words, and you'll get an email about that on Monday. But then at that one or another level care, it's more just because of the natural relationship. So in those kinds of settings, how do we care well? Listen well. Ministry phase one for Jesus was incarnation. It was Him entering our world. How do we enter somebody else's world? With our ears. We just start by listening. Getting to know what they mean by their words, hearing what their experience is. That's destigmatizing. In this whole area where depression and anxiety, my opinion, has become over-medicalized. Doesn't mean there aren't medical components to it. Every emotion that we feel has a biological component to it. So when we're asking about, is depression a chemical imbalance? Well, on the one hand, I'd say yes, always. Because there's no experience of depression or anxiety that is not chemically manifested. We're just asking in that question, whether we ask it well or not, is that the origin and cause of it? When my grandmother died, I had a chemical imbalance that was disproportionately sad. It's just the cause was this meaning-given event in my life, and the biology was the response. When I wake up in the morning and I am groggy and my brain is moving from one state to another state, that's another form of chemical imbalance that's more physiologically rooted. It's cured by a cup of coffee. A big one. But in our day and age, trying to have that as a conversation it gets to be so hard. And here's what I see in faith circles a lot, and I'm getting out of order. People, they feel bad. the idea of being on medication, somehow that means my faith is weaker or something like that. And so they sneak to their doctor or to a psychiatrist. They take the medication out of a sense of desperation. They didn't get there until things were that bad, which is a lot worse than it should have been if they'd had the conversation at an earlier stage, if the context and community of our just not just church, but culture made it feel like it was more okay to do that. They begin taking medication. It may or may not be helpful. If it's not helpful, then they quit because it's not helpful. If it is helpful, they still feel bad for it being helpful. And so then, because the medication is helpful, things get better enough that they think that they don't need it. It's in a context of shame that they're taking it, so they go off of it cold turkey. Well, if you know anything about psychotropic medications, that's a really bad idea. You kind of amp up on that. You should amp down on that. Well, what's going to happen when both because of the sense of shame, which is much more social than it is physiological, and the radical change in physiology because you go cold turkey off a psychoactive substance, are you about to have a really bad month? Yes, you are. Well, what does that do? That just confirms that I need this. Which may or may not be true. But then because all of this is being done too often in secrecy and under a sense of shame, then what begins to explain my emotions is, oh, I'm off, so I need to get my medication adjusted. Because we, in the same way we were talking about it differently earlier, we've become univariable. Now, one variable is never going to explain... rarely going to explain all of life. So we listen well. A good question that comes from Ed Welch. If your depression or anxiety could talk, what would it say? Sometimes it says, my kids are growing up way too fast. I just want to push pause on life. Sometimes it says, I've set some goals for myself that I have no way that I can reach, and I feel like a failure. Sometimes it says, really important people in my life are being ornery, and I don't know what to do about it. Sometimes I don't know what it says. It doesn't fit my circumstances at all. It's just there is this pervasive mood that I can't attach to anything that I want to get out from under. We hit that. Advise a medical checkup. If you go to bradhambrick.com/medication, I get no kickbacks on that. It's a completely free site. I give a 6-step process that's just, in my opinion, a wise approach to thinking through whether medication is or is not a good fit. Because another thing that I think happens often, you guys are going to have to listen faster. That's blame shifting and it's wrong. But another thing that I think happens out of that sense of waiting until things get that bad, and if you want to drive a counselor nuts, wait, you know, why are you talking about this now? Well, it wasn't that bad before. Oh, wait, we want to wait till it gets big and hairy, then we want to talk about it. But people wait until things get that bad. And then they introduce 3 or 4 or 5 different remedies all at once. They talk to their physician about medication, they go to a counselor, they change their diet, and they start exercising. Well, which one of those did I get relief from? I don't know. And so when you do that, what happens is you feel like you have to keep doing all of it to get the results that you got. Well, that in and of itself becomes overwhelming. And so try to give an approach where people can take more of a segmented approach that would help them figure out where am I getting relief from, study something together. I give you several studies there, a couple that we've done. Again, you've heard me talk about sin, suffering. These are step work materials. They come with notebooks that you could study along with somebody, that you could have somebody in your church come alongside and study together. All of that's free. It's available written, video, and podcast. Talk about it in your messages, whether it's sermons or lessons or social media. A big takeaway I would want a room like this to get what you talk about in your sermons and social media is what people in your church feel like it's okay to struggle with. When they don't hear it from you, they think God doesn't say anything about it. I don't belong here. The church has nothing for me. And so just, you know, a quick anecdote, putting out resources via Twitter or Facebook, that kind of thing. The great thing about social media is people can kind of look at it a little bit in the safety of their own home, kind of get their thoughts together a little bit before they want to talk about it. We can give them a safe place for that conversation. If you want to plan for that, bradhambrick.com resources gives you a plan. Keep doing life together. One of our goals is that depression and anxiety doesn't define life. And so that is where the church has an advantage that formal counseling never will. People come to me, they get frustrated, because when I come to you, I've always got to have a problem. I mean, I don't, that's kind of what counseling is. People don't come to me talking about how great life is going. But there is that sense in which counseling is very problem focused. Church doesn't have to be problem focused. This will be our wrap up point here. That's where people, in my opinion, kind of, they get really bent out of shape about stuff like AA. Like, oh, once an addict, always an addict. Well, let's just call time out and think about this for a minute. If you're in a context like AA, and the only support that you've got is from your group, what was happening when you weren't a part of group? Addiction. You found a community, you got support, you begin to walk in recovery, find some sobriety. If you're no longer an addict, where are you going to be? Alone. And so, as a way of care, hey, we want to continue to be a community for you. We're a community built around addiction. The premise helps set up what is, in some way, in the best interest. I think as a church, where we can do things that are subject-focused and targeted, but just because you reach a level of progress in a given struggle doesn't mean you have to abdicate that sense of community. You still get to be a part of it. And so the rhythms of small groups and that kind of stuff where we can talk honestly about a struggle, but that struggle doesn't have to define us or our relationship, that is a huge asset that the church is uniquely platformed in order to be able to do. Partly because I think that was God's design. So, all of that to say, the resources here in this section, the two little books are very short, brief books, because when we're depressed and anxious, we don't want to read great big books. Both of them are about 75 to 100 pages, very accessible, short chapters. The video part there are the kinds of things that you could utilize. If you go to my site, again, it's all free. You look at the G4. G4 is our support and recovery group ministries. All of our 9-step curriculum are built around that. I feel like it's a unique privilege for me to get to be pastor of counseling with no slash in my title. I think for Summit to be able to staff a position that is a counseling position that's devoted to that is a special privilege to have. The way that we steward that together is we create resources that churches can use. And so those kind of, what I would want them to be is tinker toys. Whether you're setting up people who just go through mentoring relationships, peer support group, any of that, it's all there. It can be used free of charge. So thank you for being here.